Hello and welcome to your weekly podcast, Voice Over Matters. It's Njeri Thorne bringing you all things Kenyan, the political scene, people, places, politics, policies, presidents, name it, all things Kenyan. Today I want us to look at what's been going on during the week. We've got this wheelbarrow movement that's picking up. Of course, Ruto relying heavily on the idea of populism. And just today, if you woke up to the news on the internet, what's trending is Muranga Town, because there's been some upheaval or some chaos there, and it's become somewhat a blame game as to who's been responsible for this. But let's start with this movement that Ruto is pushing, this wheelbarrow movement. No doubt it ended in a lot of accusations. We had Ruto actually being asked not to come back to the HQ for Jubilee. He's, of course, the deputy president and very much part of the Jubilee party. So we'll look at the intrigues behind this. We'll also be looking at Ruto's bid for presidency. Is it too early? We had our own president, His Excellency Uhuru Kenyatta, interviewed on Frank Van Cat while he was in France. And he has stated over and over, time and number, that this is not the time to be electioneering. This is not the time to be carrying out campaigns. There's an agenda to follow, and that's what we should be following. Of course, he has agenda four, and he's also been focused on uniting the country. We saw this in the handshake, or with the handshake, whereby there was a lot of tension and division within the country. Naturally, after any elections or any democratic elections are divisive in nature. But what the president managed to do is bring the country back together through this handshake and see if we can lead collaboratively. But back to the wheelbarrow. There's been pictures on the internet all over the place. This has been Ruto's week with wheelbarrows, whereby he hands out wheelbarrows to graduates, promising them a future with these wheelbarrows. No doubt these wheelbarrows can help people. I myself posed a question on Twitter, how is this wheelbarrow going to change your life? And I had a myriad of responses in terms of mixture. Some people insulted me that I don't know any better because I'm elite. Others actually agreed with me and said a wheelbarrow is 3,000 shillings. How is this going to help your life? Most of the responses alluded to the fact that with this wheelbarrow, you can go out there and sell fruits. Now, no doubt fruits are very healthy for you and it's a great business to get into. But you don't go to school, spend 8 years in primary school, 4 years in secondary school, another 4 years in university. Of course, all this is costing for you to come out and be given a wheelbarrow for 3,000 shillings to go and vend fruits. Of course, also what you don't want to do is saturate a market like this. With all these wheelbarrows, there's going to be 20 wheelbarrows, 20 fruit vendors in a radius of 50 meters. It's going to become turf, a war for turfs, and there'll be people protecting certain turfs, and you'll form wheelbarrow masters in different sections. So what could end up happening essentially is you start paying rent and you start paying protection money, all this so you can sell some fruits. But that is not my issue with the wheelbarrow movement. Of course, it's a great gesture, but handouts simply do not work in promoting policy that actually helps people lift themselves out of poverty. First of all, how many people can he give wheelbarrows? Kenya has a population of 47 million, of which 30 million would be in the workforce. We do have a big percentage of them, well, I don't say percentage, but unemployment is an issue. But we have the informal sector, and that's what we should be looking at in terms of policy building around that, to lift that, to promote that, enhance that, so we can enable people to put their skills to good use. The president under this administration has also focused heavily on TVETs, whereby if you don't go into university, it's vocational training. They want to introduce dignity into labor. And you can see how giving out wheelbarrows is at loggerheads with the policies that the president is looking to introduce. Now, some of these policies may not be felt immediately, long-term policies, and I'll talk about this shortly when it comes to things like infrastructure, which is where the focus of this government has been, and which is where we might see some backlash from individuals because they don't feel the benefits immediately. Infrastructure projects, of course, take long to materialize, but nobody can deny the social economic benefits that we saw with the advent of Thika Road. Not just property prices going up, but the little enterprises that built around Thika Road, the fact that people could commute, Nairobi became decongested. So that's an example of
a mega structure project that, you know, we feel the benefits today. But when it was being built, while it was happening, we weren't feeling the benefits. And this could be the reason people might have some issues around what the government is currently doing, because the benefits crystallize maybe 2-3 years after the government has left. This is a responsible government. They're looking at putting responsible policies in place. Now, what Ruto has done is capitalized on the delay between the crystallization of these projects and the actual feeling the actual benefits. And he's come in with this wheelbarrow project. I want to talk about the dignity aspect, first of all. Now, most of us know about Rwanda. We're talking about how great Rwanda is doing. The economy is growing. If we touch on leadership in terms of gender balance, Rwanda is leading the world in terms of gender parity and leadership with 58% in parliament. It's a country that's doing great. Kagame, of course, is also synonymous with the word benevolent dictator. Now, that's a debate for another day. But what we do know is Kagame does put his foot down quite hard. We know he's managed to fight corruption and he pushes policies that help the country. One of the things Kagame was known to do, and quite forcefully, was actually get rid of thatched roofs across Rwanda. Nobody was allowed a thatched roof. And some people were resistant to this initially. People did not understand the rationale behind this, but he explained it very well. It's the idea of dignity. You must live in the 21st century to a certain standard. What you don't want is people accepting the baseline and then moving on from there. If we juxtapose this alongside the wheelbarrow policy, what Ruto is doing is giving graduates baseline living. This is not what they went to school for. This is not what the 21st century is about. We Kenyans, for crying out loud, came up with M-Pesa. How do we then take a step back and steal the dreams of these graduates as a stopgap measure, give them wheelbarrows, but push them into that line of livelihood? As any parent, are you raising your child? Are you paying school fees, buying uniform so that they can then be given a wheelbarrow? Why not just give them the wheelbarrow when they turn 14, 15, when you think they're Gaelic competent and they have, you know, the sort of capacity to be out and about on their own? Why continue with schooling if this is the direction we're driving the country, if this is what opportunities are out there for the youth? So we have to be very careful not to create a baseline mentality where it's minimal possible we're aiming for. Of course, there's also issues of stealing away dreams from people. A lot of these graduates are very talented. And at times like this, you know, we need the innovation and the creativity to boost an economy. We don't want to be giving people simple solutions. And remember, Ruto's wheelbarrow dishing is not about actually helping people. This is part of his campaign. It's what we call populism, which I'll explore in more detail. A lot of people conflate the word populism with, you know, being popular. No, populism, it's a political ideology where you juxtapose the poor against the rich. And you say, you know, the poor have the moral high ground and the rich are corrupt. And you pit the two against each other and blame any shortcomings of a government or any sort of lacking of social services, jobs and so on, you blame that on the rich. It's a very dangerous narrative, and we'll look at different countries that have deployed these strategies. It does not work. But back to the wheelbarrow and my problem with it. First of all, it strips one of their dignity. You don't want to do that to a country. Secondly, it pushes graduates who are potentially innovators, potentially the next M-Pesa creators, you're putting them behind a wheelbarrow to sell fruits. And of course, I've said, you don't want to saturate a market. There's already people doing this as a means to an end. What you don't want to do is distort the market. We need to allow market forces to run themselves and allow people who have been using these wheelbarrows and selling fruits, these fruit vendors, to actually make the most of the opportunity. What you don't want is, you know, infiltrate 20, 30 wheelbarrows in a 5 meter square radius. So for me, of course, I'm against this, but it has gained traction simply because people feel that the government is not doing anything. Now, as I've stated, the government is doing a lot. They've been very responsible with long-term policies. We're an economic hub in the region. Kenya is very strategic internationally. Of course, we stand out amongst our neighbors. We want to implement infrastructure that, of course, will boost business. Now, this infrastructure benefits, they're not felt yet. And this is what is being capitalized on, compounded by the fact that, of course, we're going through a global crisis with the corona pandemic. So no doubt it's an opportune moment for Ruto to take advantage of this. We all know his ambitions for 2022, having been asked by the head of state to actually stop campaigning so that we're not in a perpetual electioneering mode. He has defied these orders and actually embraced the term that was used, tanga tanga, which in Swahili, of course, means roaming around, loitering aimlessly, and embraced that as an actual movement. So this is somebody who is supposed to deputize, as per the constitution, the president. But instead of following his orders, it's almost a mockery of his orders. Now, this is very dangerous, of course, for any state in terms of security as well. So let's look at populism as a political ideology. Of course, what happens here is you have a very charismatic leader who portrays himself as an outsider of the elite, no doubt pandering to the fear or the enthusiasm of the masses. Now, Ruto is no doubt very charismatic. He's great at mobilization. In fact, Jubilee credit him for this during the elections in 2017, 2013, in terms of bringing people together, political strategy. There's no question about it. Ruto is highly gifted here. But in juxtaposing the elite or the poor against the elite, it's interesting how he's managed to almost remove himself from the elite. Ruto is one of the richest men in the country, you know, showcasing helicopters, properties around. Of course, we also know that he's been involved in a number of scandals, corruption scandals from Kimwere Dam and Aurora Dam, amongst many others. It's rumored that there's no pie that Ruto hasn't had his fingers in. But I want us to go back to this idea of populism as a political ideology and how it works. First of all, most populists will come in, you know, on the back of claiming that there's either corruption or the government isn't doing its job, i.e. employment in this case. But most of them are authoritarian. And you'll find that most of the time, a lot of the political institutions and political goodwill that is established prior to them coming in will actually be diminished under their responsibility or under their presidency, their leadership. So I want us to look at 46 populist leaders or political parties that have been in power across 33 democratic countries between 1990 and today. And hopefully this will give us the ability to settle on the theoretical debate about the tension between populism and democracy. Because what I feel here is we're having our democracy taken away from us as we lean towards this populist ideology for leadership in Kenya. Now, we know how far we've come in this fight for democracy from Raila having been jailed for years. We know what the Moi era was like. We know what personalized governance looks like over institutionalized governance. Now, under this particular administration, of course, we've had Uhuru, and no doubt he's been the most democratic. I want to look at a few things. First of all, the media, the freedom within the media, the ability to discuss the freedom of expression. We've never felt this free as the media to discuss what we want, to openly criticize the president. Dissent is never quashed in this country. If you look at social media, for instance, there's a barrage of sort of criticism towards the president. It's something he takes in his own pace and continues governing. So that's a clear indication that democracy is thriving and working in this country. But I think what's most poignant for me was the annulment of the 2017 election. Not only did it illustrate the separation of powers amongst the three pillars of government, i.e. the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive, but also the fact that the executive, the president, actually followed the court ruling. It would have been easy to exercise power, use state machinery, and reinforce your will upon the people. But instead, the president accepted the ruling of the judiciary. And of course, we went on to another election, which he won overwhelmingly. So another example that democracy is working. This separation of powers is what keeps the checks and balances across the different pillars of government. Now, if we were to adopt the populist approach, it's something we need to understand, this idea of institutionalized governance over
personalized governance. Another thing we find with the populist leadership, which are, of course, as I keep reiterating, authoritarian. In many countries, populists rewrote the rules to the game to permanently tilt the electoral playing field in their favor. So in a study that was done, an astounding 50% of populists either rewrote or amended their country's constitution when they gained power, frequently with the aim, of course, of eliminating presidential term limits and reducing checks and balances to executive power. So we can see here, we already have in place, as I've talked about a little bit earlier, strong institutions to uphold the tenets of democracy. Now, with populism, you will find they will rewrite or amend the constitution, ideally with the aim of eliminating presidential terms. So we have to be very, very diligent when it comes to this, considering how far we've come in trying to get democracy or in our clamor for democracy. Of course, also I talked about the idea of freedom of speech, freedom of press, to participate in politics in a meaningful way. A country, a state must have freedom of press so that its citizens can make informed choices. They can protect civil liberties so that citizens are free to voice their preferences and organize around their interests. And of course, maintain political rights so that most adults have a right to participate in free and fair elections. This is a core tenet of democracy. Now, I already foresee a situation in a Ruto leadership where the press will be gagged. We all know and we all sensed a sense of fear in talking about Ruto. He was the most feared man. This is with him as not a president. So you can imagine this will be the first place he goes, freedom of speech, the media and so on. And you'll find in a lot of countries that have had populist leadership take over, there's a decline in freedom of press. In fact, 7% decline in freedom of press from the countries that were studied, 8% decline in civil liberties, and 13% decline in political rights. And then, of course, overall, 23, this is a study we're looking at, 23% of populist governments initiate democratic backsliding. We don't want to even imagine. We know what it's been like under a dictatorship. We do celebrate, interestingly enough, what we call benevolent dictators. We look at Ethiopia and we look at Rwanda and we look at the economic growth and we say, well, you know, there's less civil liberties there, there's less rights, freedom of speech and so on, and they're doing very well. But the chances of getting a benevolent dictator are almost one in a million. It's like waiting for the Messiah. It's something we must avoid at all costs. Now, I could go on and on about populism, but it's very important that we look back at our history and the struggle for freedom. And then when we look forward, we use that rearview mirror. We don't want to go back to a place where our thoughts are dictated, freedom of speech is curtailed, political participation is shaped in a way or manner that might not be beneficial to the individual in terms of voting patterns might be affected because individuals don't have choice. We could be backsliding in democracy. That is my point today. We have to be very careful with populism. We have to be very careful of charismatic characters that portray themselves as outsiders of the elite, having been part of the elite, having been associated with numerous amounts of corruption scandals. I mentioned Kim Werere and Aror Dams. As they say, Ruto has his fingers in every pie, apparently. But this idea of pitting the rich against the poor is very dangerous. It could lead to bloodshed because what we're doing is we're creating two new tribes. And the way countries move forward is by creating different ideologies, not different tribes. So you can have socialism, you can have capitalism, people can lean to the left, to the right. These are ideologies that govern the way we design our policy. They're not individualistic or personalized agendas, which is what you have with populism. When you create tribes, you pit people against one another. I want to give you a really good example of what happens when you, as a leader, ride on people's fear and enthusiasm. If we look back to Germany post-World War I, when Hitler came into power, there was, of course, what we call reparations. The German government or the German nation was made to pay back to European countries for having initiated and consequently lost the First World War. This run down Germany's economy, a large chunk of their GDP was going into paying these countries. And of course, people felt this in the economy. Now, what Hitler chose to do was blame the Jews for this, because there had been an interesting sort of social setup. A lot of the Jews, it said, the Jewish people did not go to war and they were left back home, continued with their businesses. Now, when the war was lost and reparations were being paid, people felt the hit. And Hitler blamed this on the Jews. And we all know how that ended. It ended in almost an annihilation of a whole race, where 6 million Jews, sadly and unfortunately, were killed. But this is what happens when you pit one group of people against the other and blame the other for the failure or for any issues that the country might have, for, you know, failure to provide jobs by the government, or for failure to provide social services by the government. We also see this in more recent history in South Africa with xenophobia, where the immigrants are blamed by the current government and local politicians. They're blamed, immigrants, that is, they're blamed for failure of services, for crime. And once you do this, once you pit two people or two groups of people against one another, you will no doubt end in violence. What we need to do is find groups of ideologies, debate them out, let the ideologies fight themselves out and win over the hearts of the people. Hello and welcome to your weekly podcast, Voiceover Matters. It's Njeri Thorne bringing you all things Kenyan, the political scene, people, places, politics, policies, presidents, name it, all things Kenyan.
Today I want us to look at what's been going on during the week. We've got this wheelbarrow movement that's picking up, of course, Ruto relying heavily on the idea of populism. And just today, if you woke up to the news on the internet, what's trending is Muranga Town, because there's been some upheaval or some chaos there, and it's become somewhat a blame game as to who's been responsible for this. But let's start with this movement that Ruto is pushing, this wheelbarrow movement. No doubt it ended in a lot of accusations. We had Ruto actually being asked not to come back to the HQ for Jubilee. He's, of course, the deputy president and very much part of the Jubilee Party. So we'll look at the intrigues behind this. We'll also be looking at Ruto's bid for presidency. Is it too early? We had our own president, His Excellency Uhuru Kenyatta, interviewed on Frank Van Cat while he was in France. And he has stated over and over, time and number, that this is not the time to be electioneering. This is not the time to be carrying out campaigns. There's an agenda to follow, and that's what we should be following. Of course, he has agenda four, and he's also been focused on uniting the country. We saw this in the handshake, or with the handshake, whereby there was a lot of tension and division within the country. Naturally, after any elections or any democratic elections are divisive in nature. But what the president managed to do is bring the country back together through this handshake and see if we can lead collaboratively. But back to the wheelbarrow. There's been pictures on the internet all over the place. This has been Ruto's week with wheelbarrows, whereby he hands out wheelbarrows to graduates, promising them a future with these wheelbarrows. No doubt these wheelbarrows can help people. I myself posed a question on Twitter: how is this wheelbarrow going to change your life? And I had a myriad of responses in terms of mixture. Some people insulted me that I don't know any better because I'm elite. Others actually agreed with me and said, a wheelbarrow is 3,000 shillings. How is this going to help your life? most of the responses alluded to the fact that with this wheelbarrow, you can go out there and sell fruits. Now, no doubt fruits are very healthy for you and it's a great business to get into, but you don't go to school, spend 8 years in primary school, 4 years in secondary school, another 4 years in university. Of course, all this is costing for you to come out and be given a wheelbarrow for 3,000 shillings to go and vend fruits. Of course, also what you don't want to do is saturate a market like this. With all these wheelbarrows, there's going to be 20 wheelbarrows, 20 fruit vendors in a radius of 50 meters. It's going to become turf, a war for turfs, and there'll be people protecting certain turfs, and you'll form wheelbarrow masters in different sections. So what could end up happening essentially is you start paying rent and you start paying protection money, all this so you can sell some fruits. But that is not my issue with the wheelbarrow movement. Of course, it's a great gesture, but handouts simply do not work in promoting policy that actually helps people lift themselves out of poverty. First of all, how many people can he give wheelbarrows? Kenya has a population of 47 million, of which 30 million would be in the workforce. We do have a big percentage of them, well, I don't want to say percentage, but unemployment is an issue, but we have the informal sector, and that's what we should be looking at in terms of policy building around that, to lift that, to promote that, enhance that, so we can enable people to put their skills to good use. The president under this administration has also focused heavily on TVETs, whereby if you don't go into university, it's vocational training. They want to introduce dignity into labor. And you can see how giving out wheelbarrows is at loggerheads with the policies that the president is looking to introduce. Now, some of these policies may not be felt immediately, long-term policies, and I'll talk about this shortly when it comes to things like infrastructure, which is where the focus of this government has been, and which is where we might see some backlash from individuals because they don't feel the benefits immediately. Infrastructure projects, of course, take long to materialize, but nobody can deny the social economic benefits that we saw with the advent of Thika Road. Not just property prices going up, but the little enterprises that built around Thika Road, the fact that people could commute, Nairobi became decongested. So that's an example of a mega structure project that, we feel the benefits today. But when it was being built, while it was happening, we weren't feeling the benefits. And this could be the reason people might have some issues around what the government is currently doing, because the benefits crystallize maybe 2-3 years after the government has left. This is a responsible government. They're looking at putting responsible policies in place. Now, what Ruto has done is capitalized on the delay between the crystallization of these projects and the actual benefits. And he's come in with this wheelbarrow project. I want to talk about the dignity aspect, first of all. Now, most of us know about Rwanda. We're talking about how great Rwanda is doing. The economy is growing. If we touch on leadership in terms of gender balance, Rwanda is leading the world in terms of gender parity and leadership with 58% in parliament. It's a country that's doing great. Kagame, of course, is also synonymous with the word benevolent dictator. Now, that's a debate for another day. But what we do know is Kagame does put his foot down quite hard. We know he's managed to fight corruption and he pushes policies that help the country. One of the things Kagame was known to do, and quite forcefully, was actually get rid of thatched roofs across Rwanda. Nobody was allowed a thatched roof. And some people were resistant to this initially. People did not understand the rationale behind this. But he explained it very well. It's the idea of dignity. You must live in the 21st century to a certain standard. What you don't want is people accepting the baseline and then moving on from there. If we juxtapose this alongside the wheelbarrow policy, what Ruto is doing is giving graduates baseline living. This is not what they went to school for. This is not what the 21st century is about. We Kenyans, for crying out loud, came up with M-Pesa. How do we then take a step back and steal the dreams of these graduates as a stopgap measure, give them wheelbarrows, but push them into that line of livelihood? As any parent, are you raising your child? Are you paying school fees, buying uniform so that they can then be given a wheelbarrow? Why not just give them the wheelbarrow when they turn 14, 15, when you think they're Gaelic competent and they have, you know, the sort of capacity to be out and about on their own. Why continue with schooling if this is the direction we're driving the country, if this is what opportunities are out there for the youth? So we have to be very careful not to create a baseline mentality where it's minimal possible we're aiming for. Of course, there's also issues of stealing away dreams from people. A lot of these graduates are very talented. And at times like this, you know, we need the innovation and the creativity to boost an economy. We don't want to be giving people simple solutions. And remember, Ruto's wheelbarrow dishing is not about actually helping people. This is part of his campaign. It's what we call populism, which I'll explore in more detail. A lot of people conflate the word populism with, you know, being popular. No, populism, it's a political ideology where you juxtapose the poor against the rich. And you say, you know, the poor have the moral high ground and the rich are corrupt. And you pit the two against each other and blame any shortcomings of a government or any sort of lacking of social services, jobs and so on, you blame that on the rich. It's a very dangerous narrative, and we'll look at different countries that have deployed these strategies. It does not work. But back to the wheelbarrow and my problem with it. First of all, it strips one of their dignity. You don't want to do that to a country. Secondly, it pushes graduates who are potentially innovators, potentially the next M-Pesa creators, you're putting them behind a wheelbarrow to sell fruits. And of course, I've said, you don't want to saturate a market. There's already people doing this as a means to an end. What you don't want to do is distort the market. We need to allow market forces to run themselves and allow people who have been using these wheelbarrows and selling fruits, these fruit vendors, to actually make the most of the opportunity. What you don't want is, you know, infiltrate 20, 30 wheelbarrows in a 5 meter square radius. So for me, of course, I'm against this, but it has gained traction simply because people feel that the government is not doing anything. Now, as I've stated, the government is doing a lot. They've been very responsible with long-term policies. We're an economic hub in the region. Kenya is very strategic internationally. Of course, we stand out amongst our neighbors. We want to implement infrastructure that, of course, will boost business. Now, this infrastructure benefits, they're not felt yet. And this is what is being capitalized on, compounded by the fact that, of course, we're going through a global crisis with the corona pandemic. So no doubt it's an opportune moment for Ruto to take advantage of this. We all know his ambitions for 2022, having been asked by the head of state to actually stop campaigning so that we're not in a perpetual electioneering mode. He has defied these orders and actually embraced the term that was used, tanga tanga, which in Swahili, of course, means roaming around, loitering aimlessly, and embraced that as an actual movement. So this is somebody who is supposed to deputize, as per the constitution, the president. But instead of following his orders, it's almost a mockery of his orders. Now, this is very dangerous, of course, for any state in terms of security as well.
So let's look at populism as a political ideology. Of course, what happens here is you have a very charismatic leader who portrays himself as an outsider of the elite, no doubt pandering to the fear or the enthusiasm of the masses. Now, Ruto is no doubt very charismatic. He's great at mobilization. In fact, Jubilee credit him for this during the elections in 2017, 2013, in terms of bringing people together, political strategy. There's no question about it. Ruto is highly gifted here. But in juxtaposing the elite or the poor against the elite, it's interesting how he's managed to almost remove himself from the elite. Ruto is one of the richest men in the country, you know, showcasing helicopters, properties around. Of course, we also know that he's been involved in a number of scandals, corruption scandals from Kimwere Dam and Aurora Dam, amongst many others. It's rumored that there's no pie that Ruto hasn't had his fingers in. But I want us to go back to this idea of populism as a political ideology and how it works. First of all, most populists will come in, you know, on the back of claiming that there's either corruption or the government isn't doing its job, i.e. employment in this case. But most of them are authoritarian. And you'll find that most of the time, a lot of the political institutions and political goodwill that is established prior to them coming in will actually be diminished under their responsibility or under their presidency, their leadership. So I want us to look at 46 populist leaders or political parties that have been in power across 33 democratic countries between 1990 and today. And hopefully this will give us the ability to settle on the theoretical debate about the tension between populism and democracy. Because what I feel here is we're having our democracy taken away from us as we lean towards this populist ideology for leadership in Kenya. Now, we know how far we've come in this fight for democracy from Raila having been jailed for years. We know what the Moi era was like. We know what personalized governance looks like over institutionalized governance. Now, under this particular administration, of course, we've had Uhuru, and no doubt he's been the most democratic. I want to look at a few things. First of all, the media, the freedom within the media, the ability to discuss, the freedom of expression. We've never felt this free as the media to discuss what we want, to openly criticize the president. Dissent is never quashed in this country. If you look at social media, for instance, there's a barrage of sort of criticism towards the president. It's something he takes in his own pace and continues governing. So that's a clear indication that democracy is thriving and working in this country. But I think what's most poignant for me was the annulment of the 2017 election. Not only did it illustrate the separation of powers amongst the three pillars of government, i.e. the judiciary, the legislature, and the executive, but also the fact that the executive, the president, actually followed the court ruling. It would have been easy to exercise power, use state machinery, and reinforce your will upon the people. But instead, the president accepted the ruling of the judiciary. And of course, we went on to another election, which he won overwhelmingly. So another example that democracy is working. This separation of powers is what keeps checks and balances across the different pillars of government. Now, if we were to adopt the populist approach, it's something we need to understand, this idea of institutionalized governance over personalized governance. Another thing we find with the populist leadership, which are, of course, as I keep reiterating, authoritarian. In many countries, populists rewrote the rules to the game to permanently tilt the electoral playing field in their favor. So in a study that was done, an astounding 50% of populists either rewrote or amended their country's constitution when they gained power, frequently with the aim, of course, of eliminating presidential term limits and reducing checks and balances to executive power. So we can see here, we already have in place, as I've talked about a little bit earlier, strong institutions to uphold the tenets of democracy. Now, with populism, you will find they will rewrite or amend the constitution, ideally with the aim of eliminating presidential terms. So we have to be very, very diligent when it comes to this, considering how far we've come in trying to get democracy or in our clamor for democracy. Of course, also, I talked about the idea of freedom of speech, freedom of press, to participate in politics in a meaningful way. A country, a state must have freedom of press so that its citizens can make informed choices. They can protect civil liberties so that citizens are free to voice their preferences and organize around their interests. And of course, maintain political rights so that most adults have a right to participate in free and fair elections. This is a core tenet of democracy. Now, I already foresee a situation in a Ruto leadership where the press will be gagged. We all know and we all sensed a sense of fear in talking about Ruto. He was the most feared man. This is with him as not a president. So you can imagine this will be the first place he goes, a freedom of speech, the media and so on. And you'll find in a lot of countries that have had populist leadership take over, there's a decline in freedom of press. In fact, 7% decline in freedom of press from the countries that were studied, 8% decline in civil liberties, and 13% decline in political rights. And then, of course, overall, this is a study we're looking at, 23% of populist governments initiate democratic backsliding. We don't want to even imagine. We know what it's been like under a dictatorship. We do celebrate, interestingly enough, what we call benevolent dictators. We look at Ethiopia and we look at Rwanda and we look at the economic growth and we say, well, you know, there's less civil liberties there, there's less rights, freedom of speech and so on, and they're doing very well. But the chances of getting a benevolent dictator are almost one in a million. It's like waiting for the Messiah. It's something we must avoid at all costs. Now, I could go on and on about populism, but it's very important that we look back at our history and the struggle for freedom. And then when we look forward, we use that rearview mirror. We don't want to go back to a place where our thoughts are dictated, freedom of speech is curtailed, political participation is shaped in a way or manner that might not be beneficial to the individual in terms of voting patterns might be affected because individuals don't have choice. We could be backsliding in democracy. That is my point today. We have to be very careful with populism. We have to be very careful of charismatic characters that portray themselves as outsiders of the elite, having been part of the elite, having been associated with numerous amounts of corruption scandals. I mentioned Kim Werere and Aurore Dams. As they say, Ruto has his fingers in every pie, apparently. But this idea of pitting the rich against the poor is very dangerous. It could lead to bloodshed because what we're doing is we're creating two new tribes. And the way countries move forward is by creating different ideologies, not different tribes. So you can have socialism, you can have capitalism, people can lean to the left, to the right. These are ideologies that govern the way we design our policy. They're not individualistic or personalized agendas, which is what you have with populism. When you create tribes, you pit people against one another. I want to give you a really good example of what happens when you, as a leader, ride on people's fear and enthusiasm. If we look back to Germany post-World War I, when Hitler came into power, there was, of course, what we call reparations. The German government or the German nation was made to pay back to European countries for having initiated and consequently lost the First World War. This run down Germany's economy, a large chunk of their GDP was going into paying these countries. And of course, people felt this in the economy. Now, what Hitler chose to do was blame the Jews for this because there had been an interesting sort of social setup. A lot of the Jews, it said, the Jewish people did not go to war and they were left back home, continued with their businesses. Now, when the war was lost and reparations were being paid, people felt the hit. And Hitler blamed this on the Jews. And we all know how that ended. It ended in almost an annihilation of a whole race where 6 million Jews, sadly and unfortunately, were killed. But this is what happens when you pit one group of people against the other and blame the other for the failure or for any issues that the country might have, for, you know, failure to provide jobs by the government or for failure to provide social services by the government. We also see this in more recent history in South Africa with xenophobia, where the immigrants are blamed by the current government and local politicians. They're blamed, immigrants, that is, they're blamed for failure of services, for crime. And once you do this, once you pit two people or two groups of people against one another, you will no doubt end in violence. What we need to do is find groups of ideologies, debate them out, let the ideologies fight themselves out and win over the hearts of the people.